First, though, in the 5 o'clock hour this afternoon, we welcome back to the show a longtime television journalist in the state of Maine, many years at News Center Maine. These days, you can see him at WMTW and check out the wonderful podcast In the Arena. We're happy to be joined by our friend Pat Callahan. Hello there, Pat.
Thanks, Rich. It's good to be back.
How have you been since last we chatted?
Very well. You know, this retirement thing is not so bad. And as you mentioned, I get to scratch my itch to talk politics without too much heavy lifting with my friends Phil Harriman and Ethan Strimling and do our podcast and do some on-air analysis. But, it's amazing if you do something long enough, you kind of think, gee, do I have to do this forever? And I was happy that I was able to retire after about 43 years and still like what I was doing. I'd rather, you know, get out before I start thinking, I want to drag. I don't want to do this anymore.
Well, I feel the same way. I shifted from full-time teaching to part-time, and it's I do just enough to still enjoy it every time I go in.
Yeah, that's a good way to be. And, you know, it's I'm never bored. There's always something going on and friends to visit with. And, you know, you'll see me out at Bill Green and I would go to some Maine Celtics games. And I will tell you, it's always humbling if you want to get a big head about what a celebrity you are. Go to a basketball game with Bill and no one will see you. They'll just see him because he's the man, you know, when it comes to that.
No question about that. You have done your last podcast of the season. You're taking a little break for the summer. When does it all return?
Labor Day week. So I think that's the 4th of September. When we're back. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons. For example, Phil was eager to go fly fishing. He's heading up to New Brunswick, I think, this week. And, you know, people want to do their summertime things. And honestly, we get bombarded with politics so much. And it's best sometimes just give it a rest and be fresh when things really heat up for the fall campaign season.
Well, remember the day when people said no one pays attention to the election before Labor Day? When and why did it become a year-round conversation?
Well, money is a big part of it. You know, the smart politicians know. Look, for example, at the first gubernatorial campaign for Angus King, when he was somewhat known as a personality on public TV, but he wasn't that well known. So independents don't have primaries, so a lot of people who want to run as an independent might say, oh, I can wait till late in the cycle. He recognized he got up early. I don't remember how early in the year it was, but, you know, he introduced himself to people when no one else was having that conversation. Now, so that's useful for someone like a candidate like Angus was, but it can be a little tiresome for the average person. And I got to tell you, you know, over the last couple of years, and now in particular, when I talk to friends and family and they give their thoughts on the political situation, and it's so intense, far more intense now than it used to be, and that's partly because of the personalities involved at the top of the game in Washington. And you know, I think people, it might do them all good to just kind of tune it out for a few months. We're all going to make our decisions and vote in November. Might be best, you know, go enjoy your summer and try not to dwell on it too much. I'm loath to tell anyone not to watch or listen to newscasts or read papers, but there are times you might want to just flip to the sports page and focus on that for a while.
Given the polarization that we've seen in recent years, do you think there are many people that even at this early point in the election cycle haven't made up their mind?
No, I really don't. I mean, I don't know how many persuadable people, if you're talking about a presidential race, I don't know how many people are persuadable now in particular, again, talking about the two people that are going to be the nominees. They're not even the nominees yet, and they're going to have a debate next week. But I think what can happen is what they need to do is keep their supporters engaged and make sure that they actually go out and vote. It's going to be a particular problem, I think, for President Biden if he wants to win re-election, is to draw on the goodwill of people who have supported him before and convince them that, yeah, I can still do this job and you really need me to keep doing it. That's the challenge. There are people who might be more sympathetic to his cause, but just feel, I don't like either of these guys and I just won't bother to participate. And that's not going to work either. You know, it's a binary choice, really. No offense to supporters of RFK Jr. or anybody else, but, you know, one of these two guys, Trump or Biden, is going to be the next president. So you really gotta have a say and make a decision.
We had our primaries in the state of Maine recently. Was there anything that we could learn from what we saw on primary day, whether it was the congressional race up here with Austin Terrio getting the Republican nomination, or even in some of the statehouse races?
Well, certainly in the congressional race, in CD2 in particular, the ordinarily, I don't think endorsements mean that much in main political races. But when it's Donald Trump, he's the big dog in all of that. And so those in the second district who are involved enough in politics to come out and vote in a Republican primary, they saw, okay, if Austin Terrio is good enough for Trump, then he's good enough for me. And he also had 10 times the money that Sobolewski had. So that didn't surprise me. The margin, I didn't think it would be quite as large as it was, but honestly, the outcome didn't surprise me. But it does tell you that money and a big endorsement can make a difference. Now, his job is a difficult one going into the fall, only because Maine doesn't tend to turn out incumbents. Jared Golden has had time to show people what he can do. So, you know, if even in previous years when Donald Trump was on the ballot in the second district, Jared Golden survived. So it's really, incumbency is a powerful thing. And in particular, let's remember, what's the most important job of a member of Congress? We always think of the big picture, the big issues. But really, when it comes right down to it, how good are you at constituent service? You know, if someone needs help from Washington, you go to your member of Congress, oh, you didn't get your veterans benefits, or you didn't get your Social Security check, or you need a passport expedited, whatever it is. If you have a staff that takes care of those things, people will tend to look kindly on you and reward you with being reelected.
And I'm curious, in the Jared Golden situation, he has been a guy who's been able to reach voters in both parties. He is certainly a moderate Democrat, if not a conservative Democrat. But the change in his stance on guns after what happened in his hometown of Lewiston, is that something that may have an impact on Election Day?
That's the one wild card this year. Certainly that bothers some voters if you think, well, he's evolving on this or changing on this, it might somehow threaten my right to have a particular weapon. But I also think the impact of the shootings in Lewiston, particularly, of course, and Lewiston and Auburn are in the second district, particularly there, people are going to remember and say, yeah, maybe ordinary people shouldn't have this kind of weapon, that it's a military weapon. And that's what Golden has come to the conclusion for. And he would know because he has used that weapon in warfare. So I think, you know, yes, if you can paint him as anti-gun in a broad way, that's a problem for him. If he can focus it on, look, I'm looking just to change access to this type of weapon, I think he can probably do okay.
We're talking with Pat Callahan here on Downtown. Is the Maine legislature, either the House or the Senate, or perhaps both, really up for grabs?
Well, you know, it always is. It was interesting this year to see the number of contested primaries there were. I suspect part of that was because of the new semi-open primary format in which you don't have to belong to a party to vote in a party primary. So perhaps, you know, there were Republicans and Democrats thinking, if I jump into this and make a challenge against an incumbent, I've got a shot because I might be able to bring some independents along with me or some unenrolled people. Don't know if the numbers bear that out. I haven't seen any analysis, but that might be one reason we saw an unusual number of primaries. The other, the most interesting one to me, was the one in Waterville, in which you have a pro-life Democrat incumbent who was ousted by a pro-choice Democrat in the primary and was backed by Planned Parenthood. I don't believe they've ever been involved in a party primary before. So we've seen the power of that particular issue in Democratic politics. So that certainly was an interesting one. And the results show that issue is a strong motivator for a lot of voters.
Is this Angus King reelection bid the most quiet Senate race you can recall?
Well, his usually are. The fact is, polls show he's the most popular politician in the state and has been for some time. When it's time for him to do debates, he'll sit down with his opponents. And the fact is, he's really good at that. He's smart and can handle any attacks on him and explain his positions in a way that it's real talk to people. So, you know, obviously anything is possible, but it's a huge uphill climb for anyone to oust him, just as it will be in the first congressional district where, you know, you had two Republicans, newcomers, who wanted to run against Shelley Pingree, and that was a toss-up. No one really knew what to expect in that one. And that's because when it comes to the fall, she's awfully hard to beat, especially in a district like CD1.
Pat, who do you think is positioning themselves to potentially succeed Janet Mills as governor?
That's a good question. A lot of people suggest, well, Jared Golden might. He certainly has made noises that he doesn't want to stay in Congress forever. There are a lot of good reasons for feeling that way. Some people get that job and never want to let it go. I don't think that's in his nature. But I also wonder, and I can't claim to know him that well, but I've spent quite a bit of time talking with him one-on-one. And, you know, I'm not sure. He doesn't seem to enjoy, to me, again, this is my opinion, I don't think he enjoys a lot of the duties of campaigning all the time. He does it because he has to. But I think if you want to run for governor, that's a different kind of role. And if that's a job that really requires engagement on a personal and political level that I'm not sure maybe he wants to do. So we'll find out if he's interested in that. Certainly if he wins re-election this fall, he would be the number one prime candidate for Democrats. On the Republican side, you know, I'm not sure how strong the bench is. All I can tell you is if history is any guide, the next governor is most likely to be a Republican or an independent, because we have not had a party succeed itself in the gubernatorial administrations since Ed Muskie was elected. If you look back to
Ken Curtis, right?
Ken Curtis, yeah. Well, even before that, but because you had John Reed, who was a Republican before that. He got in there by the fact that Democratic governor passed away, and he was Senate president. Well, John Reed, then he's a Republican. Ken Curtis, a Democrat. Jim Longley, an independent. Joe Brennan, Democrat. Jock McKernan, Republican. Angus King, independent. John Baldacci, Democrat. Paul LePage, Republican. Janet Mills, Democrat. Now, it's an interesting, obviously, it's perhaps just a curiosity, or it's an indication that Mainers give everybody their 8 years. You know, we gave you your shot, now let's let someone else try this. So if I'm a Republican or an independent, I'm thinking, well, you know, this could work out well. But I honestly don't know who the Republicans might be, unless maybe a moderate Republican like a Rick Bennett, someone like that, could be thinking about it. We will certainly, after these elections, after November, Janet Mills, in a sense, becomes a lame duck, you know, because now people are thinking who's going to be the next governor. Not that she can't still do her job, but politically speaking, there will be a lot of people looking in the mirror and seeing a potential governor looking back at them.
Do you think we're seeing fewer candidates rise through the ranks and position themselves for those larger statewide offices or congressional seats since we instituted term limits in the legislature?
That's possible. You know, you don't have as much of a chance to really build a name. Then again, even with term limits, you still have people, many legislators who move from chamber to chamber after they're termed out in one or the other. So, you know, it doesn't seem to be quite as obvious as it used to be. But, you know, there are always surprises that come out of this kind of politics. So it will be interesting to see who tries to step up. You know, does someone like a Billy Bob Falkingham for the Republicans want to, you know, take a shot at the Blaine House? Who knows? We'll see that unfold come 2025.
We lost a giant in the Maine political scene recently with the passing of former governor, former congressman Joe Brennan. What do you remember most about him?
Well, I'll tell you, when I came to Maine in 1979, I honestly didn't know that much about Maine politics. I knew who Ed Muskie was and who Margaret Chase Smith was. She wasn't in office anymore. But Ed Muskie was kind of the only guy, because he'd been a national figure. And I grew up outside of Boston, so we all knew who he was. But I got to Maine and had to start learning about the politics here. And when I went to cover things at the State House, I suddenly realized, okay, you got Joe Brennan, you got Dave Flanagan, Dave Redmond, all in the administration, Barry Hobbins, all these Irish Americans around us saying, oh, I feel right at home. I know these people. These are my people. So I remember telling that to Joe after he was out of office. I said, I got to thank you for being who you were and, you know, your background. It made me feel like I understand these people, and it made it fun to cover. And I have to tell you, I think he was just an awfully down-to-earth guy. You know, he was the neighborhood guy from Munjoy Hill who never left there. You know, he grew up there, did his work. You know, I think the only other places he lived were the Blaine House, and I'm sure he had the place in Washington when he was working there. But You know, he was a Portland guy through and through, and he died blocks from where he was born. So you'd see him on the street occasionally and stop and chat and just friendly, you know, down-to-earth kind of guy. And he had a really good sense of how to help working people in Maine. And he famously would talk frequently about the best social program is a job. Let's make sure we invest in, what's his famous phrase, fish piers, cargo ports, potato packing sheds, all of the things that can help create jobs. So he was he really did his best for this state, and it did it in a way that he conducted himself with great dignity and responsibility and kindness to an awful lot of people.
And part of that generation where, regardless of political affiliation, people who really believed in their heart of hearts that this was public service. You were there to help people.
Well, that's it. And, of course, if there's any knock on Joe Brennan, it's that he didn't really know when to leave the stage. Mm. He kept running for offices again. And you know, at some point people are kind of saying you had your day. And that's hard to do, hard to let go of. But yeah, I think it was always with the best of intentions in that, you know, let's face it, you could tell when he left, he was term limited out as governor and Jock McKernan succeeded him, and they essentially swapped jobs. Joe took the CD1 congressional seat. But that if you've been the boss, if you have been the number one guy, it's suddenly hard to be one of 435 and a backbencher. So, you know, I don't think he enjoyed it as much as he enjoyed it being governor, and he really did. And the other thing was, and I, of course, as someone who was in the media, I respected and enjoyed the fact that he didn't treat us as we're the enemy. You know, he recognized we had a job to do, and he didn't. I'm sure he didn't always like the coverage he got, but he never whined about it. And he would, you know, if you needed something from him, and he was in his office, he'd come in and give you 5 minutes, because he recognized that's how I get my message out to the people of Maine. If I want them to support my policy, I've got to explain it to them, and that's how you do it. So, honestly, that made the job much easier to do and a lot more fun. Never, however, never play pool with him for money. So that I learned as well.
On the most recent podcast, you talked about another Maine political legend, Ed Muskie, and that famous temper of his. And you had the conversation about whether it got out of hand or whether he used it to move his agenda.
Yeah. Now I will tell you that I got to know Ed, you know, after he was out of office and there was no axe to grind. So we got along very well. I've talked to other people, even in the Democratic Party, people who've been involved for a long time, who did not especially enjoy his company. But that was, you know, that was their particular engagement with him, different than mine. But the stories I've heard from enough people who would know, who were there, said made it clear he could be very difficult to work for. He could really put the fear of God into staffers. And, you know, Angus King talks about it. He was a staffer for the name just flew out of my head. The senator that Cohen defeated. But anyway,
Bill Hathaway.
Hathaway, sure. But Angus worked for Bill Hathaway. But he said he sometimes would have to brief both of the senators before they'd go on the floor to vote, and Muskie would just glare at him and say, "You better be right." I do think there were times it got out of hand. The most famous example was the one when he decided when he was running for president, he had to go down to the Manchester Union Leader and berate Bill Loeb for attacking his wife in print. Now, anybody would be angry about that. His staffers, he admits, tried to tell him, don't do it. You know, it's not going to be worth it, but he went anyway. And it looked like he was having, you know, he was crying or something, which may or may not have been true. But in those days, politicians weren't allowed to shed a tear. It just couldn't happen. He must be unstable. So it contributed to this feeling that maybe this guy, it doesn't have the temperament for the job. It shows you how much things have changed since 1972. I think now that would be the least of anyone's problems.
Well, I used to show that video to students and say, now, let's watch another video 25 years later, Bill Clinton running for president and him tearing up talking about his wife on 60 Minutes. And boy, the poll numbers went up immediately.
Yeah. And even with someone like Ronald Reagan, he showed you could sort of shed this manly tear depending on the circumstances and the subject of what you're talking about. He'd get very sentimental. Things were changing as people like, let's face it, Reagan and Bill Clinton were great communicators, and they knew how to do the stagecraft, the showbiz of politics. I'm not saying their feelings were not real, but they also knew when it was time to put that on stage. Whereas in Muskie's day, then that just hadn't been done. Remember, you know, Tom Eagleton in that 72 race, once it was found that he had been having psychological problems and was being treated for that, he was poisoned, you know, and McGovern had to dump him as vice president. And I don't know that that would happen today. I think there's much more, people look at things differently, and rightly so. You should be able to look at some of the mental health issues and say, well, that's no different than if you're being treated for a physical health problem.
You'll like this. When I was working at Channel 2, this was back in the early 90s, I think, and I think Ed was, I think he was retired at this point. He came in, and I had met him way back first in 72 when I was a young volunteer on Bill Hathaway's campaign, and had talked to him a number of times through the years. And so he knew who I was and knew my name. But anyway, he was in the newsroom, and I was sitting at my little sports desk, and he was down there to be interviewed by people upstairs on the set. And so he was putting in his IFB, and he had said hello, and all I could hear was his end of the conversation. And I saw him, I could tell that he was getting mad with the questions because he had clenched his fists and he shook his head a couple times, and he corrected whoever was interviewing him a couple of times. And he got done with the interview and thanked them and ripped out his IFB and looked at me and said, "Richard, where do they find these people?"
Oh, man. Well, that's interesting. One interesting encounter with him was at the 1992 Democratic National Convention. And he was one of the speakers at that convention. And he was hailed as the, you know, one of the conquering heroes. Here's one of our stalwart Democrats. They introduced him as the man from Maine and played the Stein song and everything. And afterwards, I did an interview with him, and man, was he happy. I don't think I'd ever seen him so happy, because he's back in the game. You know, he had, for a moment, there he is back in the thick of it. And he admitted to me when we did interviews for the documentary I did on him, and he said it was tough when he left the Senate to become Secretary of State. And once Jimmy Carter was defeated, that job was gone. So he kind of was now out of politics, perhaps sooner than he had planned to be. But he says those Senate years, those were the great years.
By the way, that documentary you did was absolutely wonderful. I used that. I think I wore out my VHS copy of it, showing it to my class for years and years in Maine history.
Good. Well, he's a guy people should know about. You know, I think it's important to know as much history if you're covering government and politics, to have some sense of, have we been here before? And, you know, what was the outcome then? You know, not everyone is as passionate about it as you and I might be, but it's worth knowing who these people were. And so that's one of the things that I found most satisfying about my career, is chronicling the stories of some really remarkable people from Maine, Olympia Snow and George Mitchell, Bill Cohen. You know, they started out as just very humble beginnings, but they're smart and hardworking, and whatever their politics are, they're doing their best to try to make life better for people in Maine and in the country. And that can be inspirational, especially now. I think it's a good idea to remember that is possible. It doesn't mean they're not fierce partisans. It doesn't mean they're going to be wrong sometimes. But their goal is a lofty one. And you want to remind people that is still possible.
Pat, what will you be checking out for concerts this summer?
It's a good question. We're going to see Old Crow Medicine Show at the State Theater.
Nice.
We actually saw them about 6 weeks ago. They played in Portsmouth at the Music Hall there, which is a lovely venue. And we thought, hey, they're playing at the State again. We might as well go twice, because they put on such a great show. So that'll be fun. Going to see Ringo in Massachusetts in September.
Wonderful.
So we haven't got too much booked. Oh, I know. The Saw Doctors are playing in Boston in July. We're going to that. That's an Irish rock band, for those who don't know, and haven't seen them in quite a while. So that's a few things that are on our agenda.
Well, I look forward to seeing the adventures that you have and following them on social media, as always. It is great to talk with you again. Pat, thanks for making time for us. Have a wonderful summer, and we'll check in with you perhaps right before the election.
Yeah, that'll be great. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you reaching out and letting this old man ramble on.
Thanks so much, Pat.
See you, Rich.
That's Pat Callahan with us here on Downtown.